For WUGA, I'm Kathy Bradbury. This station is proud to present the StoryCorps Athens Winter Special, a collection of interviews as part of a national initiative to record the stories of everyday people. All stories here were recorded at the StoryCorps mobile booth in October and November of 2018 and were produced locally by Morgan Heidrich. The holidays are a time to thank and remember those people who have impacted us the most. The first two stories are from people who have recognized the impact family and friends can have on our lives. Longtime friends Jeanette Hill and Sylvia Hutchinson have decades of teaching between them and currently work at the University of Georgia. In this conversation, they discuss how they came to love teaching and how this passion has drawn them closer together as friends.
You've been an incredible mentor to me, which I've shared with you
many
times.
Works both ways.
Oh, thank you. That's very kind. And you've opened up so many opportunities for me, particularly with teaching and moving into new areas that I never even considered that I'd go into. So I want to talk to you more about teaching because I know that that's a shared love with the two of us. But I'd like to talk to you first a little bit about your background.
I had a wonderful team of women in my life, my mother and my grandmother. Plus, I had wonderfully bright teachers all through school, exceptional teachers who were kind and innovative and really students themselves of an appreciation for learning was a part of the life.
And so it sounds like you really enjoyed school.
I did. Oh, I loved it.
Yeah.
I went to school during the day and I played school in the afternoon. My poor brother and sister, before they could sit up, I would strap them into a chair and try to teach.
So this is something that we've never talked about.
That's
in the
right.
Whole time we've known each other.
Is that
but
so?
This is something that we share.
Yeah.
Because I did the same thing to my two younger sisters.
Yeah.
Where they might say I strapped them in, but for sure we would go into school and then come. That would be what I wanted to play.
Yeah.
Was teacher. So you mentioned that you had a lot of women who
yes.
were very influential in your childhood and maybe on into your adulthood. Could you talk a little bit about them?
First and foremost, my mother, and you've known me
yes.
for a while, so you know I have lots of mama stories. My grandmother was entirely different person, but also very influential and always encouraging. And they didn't tell me that I could do anything. They never told me that, but they told me I could set lofty goals and I could work hard. I never remember getting up, going to bed, mama wasn't reading. We saw her reading all the time, and everything that was on the shelf was open to us. But the city library was just a couple of blocks from my elementary school. And a couple of times a week, I'd go to the city library and check out books. And I came home early one afternoon. She said, "What was wrong? Was the library closed?" I said, "No, ma'am. They told me I could not go into the section I wanted to go into. I could only stay in the children's section." And we walked back down to the library. And I don't know what she said to the librarians, except I heard her say, "I taught Sylvia to read. Not what I told her to read and not what you tell her to read. I taught her to read. She may go anywhere in this public library she chooses to go." They never delimited me again.
Wow. Well, and I can tell you, being your colleague who's been in a classroom with you and has had the great treat and blessing to co-teach with you.
You're sweet.
It is true, because I see what happens in your classroom and those students and how you interact with them. It's amazing,
Sylvia. It's just fun to me.
Yeah.
It is absolutely I can't imagine not teaching. I can't imagine staying home. I don't know if they ever tell me they don't want me.
Yeah.
I don't know what I'll do.
Yeah. It sounds like to me that teaching is a core identity for
you.
Oh,
absolutely.
Yeah.
That's the first thing I wrote on the sheet. Yeah.
Yeah.
If anybody asks me who I am, that's the first thing I would say.
The next story is told by Dr. Herman McKeithen and his sister Yvonne McKeithen. As a child, Dr. McKeithen faced a lot of bullying from kids at school until one memorable day when his sister got involved. Let's hear both sides of the story.
During bus rides to and from school, bullying was the norm for me. If you developed a passion for learning and you expressed your feelings to anyone on the bus, you were ostracized and you were bullied with physical abuse. I loved learning new things. Therefore, I was bullied and beat regularly during the afternoon bus rides from school. I would arrive home from school with scratches and bruises regularly. My mother was always working hard for us, but she would sometimes dismiss my abuse. So I lived with my abuse quietly for a few years. Well, one afternoon while returning home from school on the school bus, the bullies plotted to give me the beating of my lifetime. I remembered crying my heart out during the entire bus ride home. And I remembered my heart racing as I exited the bus. As I stood at the bus stop, approximately 10 bulliers surrounded me in a circle, and they were ready to pounce on me like lions ready to devour their prey.
I was standing around, and I noticed the crowd of bullies around my brother. I didn't have any fear. I jumped in the middle of the group. I was standing with my two fists tightly crimped. I started at the bullies with a strong sense of defiance. I began to shout at them, saying, "I dare you to touch my brother. I dare you to lay a hand on him." I was about 2 feet shorter than my brother, so I was scared for both of us.
But miraculously, all the bullies in the group froze in their tracks. None of them bullied, and none of them ignored my sister's commands. The bullies ran away, and I just stood there in a state of shock. Then Yvonne gave me a big hug, and we walked home without one incident. No one ever bullied me again. She restored my passion for learning, and she rejuvenated me never to live in fear from bullying ever again. I was struck by her bravery, and she continues to be a community advocate even today for the downtrodden and citizens lacking hope and trust in their environments. My love for learning, coupled with my sister's love, encouraged me to complete high school, college, and eventually obtaining a PhD. However, after working in academia for a few years, I discovered a new form of bullying and abuse occurring among doctoral students trying to earn their degrees. College students were dropping out of their doctorate programs, and the rates were higher for minority doctorate students. And some college officials were setting up doctoral program roadblocks for some students. So I created a program called Academics Unraveled, where I assess and coach failing doctoral students to determine if they are experiencing academic abuse and to remove any roadblocks that are designed to prevent them from graduating. I am thankful for my sister Yvonne because she helped me to overcome bullying. I love you, big sister.
I love you too, Herman.
The holiday season is often the one time of year when families across the country can get together and share advice, old memories, and stories. In the next two segments, we'll hear conversations between parents and children as they reminisce and offer advice for the future. Kay and Christina Martin are mother and daughter, and Christina recently became a mother herself. In this conversation, Christina talks to her mother about the feeling of becoming a new mom and the hopes they each have for Christina's son.
Since I recently became a parent and you've had an opportunity to observe some of those early days, I wanted to, discuss some comparisons between those early days with my parenthood and the early days of your time as a parent. Can you tell me about when you found out you were pregnant with me?
I took a home pregnancy test and I don't recall if I came up with the blue or what the actual result was, but, I was just ecstatic, just super happy to know that I was going to be a mom.
Can you tell me how it felt when I told you you were going to be a grandma?
Oh, my goodness. overwhelmingly ecstatic. I mean, we knew there was some possibility of that happening over the course of time, but then when it's actually there, it's just like unbelievable. I mean, that day I went out and started looking at onesies. I think you said it was a little early to be thinking about that. This far in, how do you feel about being a mom? I mean, I heard you called him son very soon after he was born, and I did the same thing. I was like, oh, my little daughter, not just my child, you're my little daughter.
Mm-hmm. Well, I have a lot of feelings about it. It can be pretty overwhelming. Of course, at the same time, it's just overwhelming feelings of love for him. For example, the other night he was away just stirring and moving around in his crib, and I was trying to just listen to him and let him soothe himself, but I really wanted to scoop him up and bring him in to lay next to me. And I think it was because I missed him, even though he was 1.5 feet away from me. So how do you think his childhood will be different than my childhood was, or than your childhood was?
You know, one thing I really wonder about is the technology and his knowledge of his world. Rough things were going on when I was a child also in the world. There were some really scary things happening, but it wasn't as accessible. How do you use that for, you know, empathy and understanding your world?
I also don't know how to balance protecting him, but also letting him explore the world around him.
I mean, you do have for him a lot more acceptance than we did either of our childhoods. I mean, that's evolved a lot. It's going to be an adventure.
Mm-hmm. What are your hopes for me as a mom?
You know, you're very independent, very, you know, strong woman, and just kind of, you know, passing that along to your child and, you know, about that, having that role model of a strong, independent mom who, you know, also be nurturing and loving and supportive and all those things.
Our next story comes from father and daughter duo Brian and Natalie Glazier. In this story, Natalie asks about her dad's grandparents, and Brian talks about the profound impact they had on everyone around them.
When I would meet people, they would sometimes say, oh, your name's Glazier, were you related to J.W.? And I'd say, yeah, it was my grandpa, but I didn't know him. And they'd say, well, you know, he was pretty much a legend because he stored fish guts in his car, and he always had a bottle of wine and some cheese and chicken guts because he would work, and then on the way home he'd stop and go fishing, and that nobody would ride in a car with him. And this fellow said that he was hitchhiking or he was trying to get home. He said, Grandpa pulled over and said, you can ride. And he said he stuck his head in the door and rode back to London Mills on the running board on the outside of the car. He didn't want to get in the car with Grandpa because it just smelled too bad. But then other people in the family said, well, he did that on purpose because he didn't want to take anybody for a ride.
So do you know anything about their love story of him and his wife, how they met, any of that?
Well, my mom being the daughter-in-law, her story in it was that J.W. worked and he drank, and that Grandma May was the one that held the family all together, and that it was an unusual arrangement for the 20s and 30s in that she owned some property herself. They said that just was unheard of, that a woman would own some property. She was kind of a midwife, but she had ran like a boarding house. So Dad always said there were more people at the dinner table who weren't family members than family members, because all sorts of people would stay there. And there was a fella who came up to me once when I was in high school and said, are you a Glazier? And I said, yeah. And he said, well, I grew up with your dad at their house, because he said, I didn't have any place to go, so your grandma took me in, and I just lived there all the way through high school. And when I was went back to graduate school and was at Indiana State, one of my professors, her name was Elizabeth Shulson, and so one time we went home, and my mom said, well, tell me about your professors, and I just was listing them off, and I said, Elizabeth Shulson. And she said, well, I wonder if that's so-and-so's Shulson's wife. And I said, I doubt it very much. And she said, well, go ask her about her husband, because if it's him, he was our principal here in London Mills, and he lived at your dad's house.
Was it?
Yeah. I'm sorry. That's right.
We wanted the payoff.
Yeah, I'm sorry. I didn't give you the payoff.
We've all heard the phrase, it's a Christmas miracle, and there's no denying that miracles play significant roles in many holiday movies and television shows. In the next two segments, we'll hear about some real-life miracles straight from the people who experienced them. When Erin Thompson-Pogden was in a terrible car accident in college, her mother, Ellen Trenrood, was afraid for her daughter's life. But what happened to Erin was nothing short of remarkable. Here's Erin's story.
We have an unusual, amazing family where the old parts get along with the new parts.
We do. But everybody used to say we should be on Jerry Springer. They're like, your parents get along that well?
Totally. It's kind of insane. They're coming for Thanksgiving. We'll all be together.
When I tell people we've taken, like, vacations together, like the step-parents and the parents and the kid, they're like, what?
I know. And by choice, it's just been really good. Really
and
good.
It is. And Lindsay and I are so lucky in that, because I do think it's the exception and not the rule.
Oh,
and
without a doubt.
We've, I think it's taught us on the larger scale to share. I want to like change gears a little bit.
Okay.
Have you experienced any miracles?
Well, you know I have. I witnessed one on a Black Friday after we'd had a family Thanksgiving, and you know about this. You were home from Boston University for a Thanksgiving vacation, and you decided you wanted to go up and visit a friend in Tennessee, you know, not very far away.
Chattanooga.
And you got in Papa's shiny, relatively new red truck and took off. For whatever reason, we had turned off the answering machine and we weren't, we didn't have it on. I think it was because
Lindsay turned it down, the volume.
Because it beeped during dinner and she
something.
Didn't like the beep.
Yeah.
So anyway, Papa and I had gone out to look for appliances and we got home and all of a sudden the phone rang and it was... Maybe it
wasn't
Ted.
It was Ted.
And he called and said that there had been an accident. And not to worry, that you were fine. But then I looked down at the numbers on the answering machine. There were like 8 messages on there from State Patrol, from all sorts of things. They said, just come on. She's fine. She's in the hospital in Chattanooga and just drive up here. And all we knew was that there had been an accident. We didn't know what. When we got up there, you were standing there in the hall and apologizing about Papa's truck, and you had a Band-Aid on your head. I mean, you had a pretty good bump on your head, without a doubt.
Yeah.
But the miracle was that you fell asleep on the highway and drove up into an overpass, hit it, and rolled down onto the highway facing oncoming traffic on one of the busiest days of the year in 4-lane traffic. And no one else was hurt, and you survived. You know, we went the next day. I know you remember, and we went to the scene to go get stuff out of the truck.
Yeah. Well, we had to go to that salvage.
Yes. And there was the truck all covered in grass and creamed. But the miracle was there were people behind you, and they saw it starting to happen. The wife said, oh, my God. The husband looked in his rearview mirror and saw semis just parting, you know, like parting of the water behind them. And they watched you roll through this accident. They got out and came to you really fast.
Yeah.
And they kept asking you if you were alone, because you kept asking them, is the other person okay? Are they okay? And they thought someone had been thrown. And then you finally said, no, I was alone. And by then there were other people there to help you, and they flew you away in a helicopter. But the next day when we went back to get the truck and the parts and the things, there was a tennis shoe, an Adidas tennis shoe.
Adidas size 12.
In the front of the truck on the floor, and another one thrown in the back, in the bed of the truck.
No, there was one on the seat and one on the floor. Like, they were with me.
and
in the truck.
And
like they had been there, like they were.
Lindsay used that truck for school. And we thought, well, possibly those were shoes of a friend of hers. She said, I don't know anybody that wears that size of shoe. I guess they could have been on the side of the road or who knows what, but they were there. Yeah. And your godfather had passed away, and he wore that size Adidas all his life. It was his favorite thing. He was buried in them.
He was buried in size 12 Adidas.
And I think he was there holding the roof up on the truck. We both believe it. And another thing that was so bizarre was that in Papa's office, he didn't go back until the following Tuesday.
Yeah.
And the clock on his wall in his office stopped at the time of your accident.
Yeah, they windowed it into like 10 minutes, and his clock was stopped in that window.
He took it off the wall, never put a battery back in it, and just left it.
Yeah. And we figured the battery had died, but that it would just be sitting in that window.
So it was all amazing. And then when I did talk to the State Patrol, I said, I see where she went off the road, and I see where she went up. How did this happen? I said, did she slow down? And he goes, oh, no, ma'am. He said she fell asleep. She went faster. And he said if she hadn't, she would have hit lower, and she would have gone under and been decapitated. So so it was like the perfect accident. There were things that made it all come together. Yeah, was it a miracle? Absolutely, no doubt.
Stanley Stroud was lucky enough to witness two self-proclaimed miracles in his life, one during his own childhood and one when his son was an infant. Stroud tells his friend Quint Newcomer about both of these experiences.
You told me a story as we were standing outside before we came in here. Tell me about that story again.
Yeah, we built this treehouse. Our parents had told us, you know, before y'all get in the treehouse, we got to inspect the treehouse, you know, to make sure it's safe and everything. And so one day, me and the cousins, we decided to go to the treehouse. I go up in the treehouse, even though they said not to, and the treehouse fell. I fell on it with my feet first, through a bunch of nails. And so I knew I was wrong by doing it, so I didn't tell nobody. So I let it go on for like, I guess about 2 or 3 days, and finally I had to just say, hey, something wrong with my feet, you know? And so mom would take me to different doctors and stuff, you know, to try to fix my feet and everything. And they told me it was too late, that I developed gangrene, and they couldn't do anything about it. So they wanted to amputate. They took me around to different doctors, and if they said amputate, she would say, no, not my baby's feet. One day we was in a grocery store line, and she was holding me, and this guy behind us is, what's wrong with your kid? She said, oh, well, he's got something on his feet, you know. He said, well, you might have a look at him. So she let him see it. He said, well, I can fix that. And she said, well, you can? He said, yeah, you know. He gave her a card, and he said, well, this is my address. He said, bring him to see me in the morning. So the next day she takes me to this guy, and he fixes up this stuff in his bag and looked like mud or something, and he put bags on my feet. He said, well, let it stay on there for a couple of weeks. He said, it'll clear up. And so that happened. It cleared up. And so she was trying to figure out, you know, what she did with the card. She couldn't find the card. And she's like, well, I know the building's there, so I'm going to take it back to him, you know, and let him know that it worked, you know. So we go back to this place. It's not a doctor's office, and the doctor didn't exist. And so I just look at it and say, well, it was an angel.
You did. You had an angel looking out for you.
Yeah.
You have some other really interesting stories, and you told me about your son when he was younger. And tell me about the miracle of the doctor taking care of your son.
Yeah, my oldest son, Tequio, he was born with a heart disease. So we would have to take him back and forth to the doctor. And eventually he said, well, he's going to have open heart surgery. And we had to go in and close these holes up in his heart because he could barely breathe, you know. And he was 8 months old. So we took him to Atlanta. They did the surgery on him, and they said recovery on this surgery it's going to be like 3 to 4 months, you know. And the very next day, we were sitting in the room, you know, and we were like, where'd he go? You know, I don't know if we closed our eyes for 2 seconds or what, but he jumped out the hospital bed. But he didn't know how to walk before we got to the hospital. And so I'm like, where's my kid? You know, we were like trying to find him. And then the nurse, well, we don't know, but is that your kid going down the hallway? And we looked outside the hallway. He was running down the hallway. And I said, yeah, that's him right there. He said, he just had surgery yesterday. I'm like, yeah. They said, oh, my gosh. They couldn't believe it. They're like, this kid was not even walking when he got in the hospital. Now he's running up and down the hallway.
And how's he doing now? How old is he now?
He's doing great. I think he's around 35 now, I think. And he plays drum for Big and Rich.
That's amazing.
Yeah, he's drum for Big and Rich now.
Family stories have a way of getting passed down through the generations, and there's no better time than the holidays to tell these stories over and over again. In this next conversation, Karen Giroux asks her mom, Martha Sweeney, to retell some of her stories about growing up in Ireland and a special family gift. Here's Karen and Martha.
The girls told me to ask their favorite stories about you being chased by a bull. So they said,
oh,
to start
dear
there.
God. Okay. The bull story was, when we were young, all of us on my street and some other streets would go out into the countryside to pick mushrooms. And you were always warned, don't go in where the cows are or the bull, because you'll regret it. But I always wanted to pick the most mushrooms because I was in love with this boy and I could get him to pay attention to me if I gave him all my can of mushrooms. So this day, I knew the bull was in the field, but it didn't bother me because I was so brave. I went in and I was getting all of the mushrooms. My can was full, and out of nowhere came the bull chasing after me. I dropped my can of mushrooms, which I always regret, climbed over the wall as quickly as I could, and made my way home sad because he ignored me all the way home. That was that story.
Now I know why they like that story. Another story I remember is Granny. So Granny was able to put a curse on people.
Oh, absolutely. Widows in Ireland can put a curse on anyone. Well, I'll only tell one. It was this man. My grandmother had had farms and property outside of Birr. We had this sleazy cousin, and he wanted those. And my grandmother was getting older and also running out of money because her pub, there were five pubs on her street, and she being a widow, the others would, all of the patrons would go into the other pubs where they could have more fun, I suppose. But anyway, Granny just was losing track of things. And so this man cheated her out of some of her fields, because that's the land of fields. And so my mother, oh, and he kicked our dog and he poisoned the dog. This dog my brother-in-law had given to me, and he was a gorgeous little black curly-haired lab. And this man poisoned him because the dog was always worrying his cattle. Mm-hmm. And so then my mother told him, she said, the leg you lifted to kick that dog, you'll die roaring with that leg. And sure enough, when he was dying, the whole street could hear him screaming in pain because they could do nothing for his pain. So that was in the 50s, remember.
Is this the one who died in the field, or is this a different one?
No.
What about the one who died in his field?
Oh, that was a man who owned a gigantic house. Now, I tell this story because my mother told him, but I was 7 months when we left there, so I really don't remember this. So my sisters and brothers would have to cut across his fields to get out to the road to get transportation into school in the village. Mm-hmm. And he would come to my mother and say, I don't want your children crossing my field. And my mother told him not to worry about that, he wouldn't last the winter, that the children would be still traveling across the field and he would be gone. Well, we had a very bitter cold. It was ice and snow. And he slipped outside of his gigantic wall that he used to protect his house and lay there all night and was dead in the morning. So that was the widow's curse.
So when I grew up hearing those stories, I started thinking about whether or not you could put curses on people. And you're a seventh daughter, right?
Mm-hmm.
So
I am.
That would have some significance to me. But that made me nervous that I could put a curse on people, and I'm kind of a bit of a hothead.
You are.
I would just say that I hope they stub their toes, just in case I had the same powers that you and Granny did. So didn't somebody try to take half of the kids away even after, when you were older?
No.
I thought they were trying to give you to new families.
No, no, no. That was a cousin of my mother named Frank, lived up in the north of Ireland. And he and his wife had no children. So he wrote to my mother and said, dear Cousin Annie, because you have so many children and we cannot have a child, would you give us one of yours? And we will give that child anything they want. And we'll send them to the best school around. And of course, I wanted a piano. because I was taking piano lessons. I was 10 years old. So I put my hand up and said, I'll go with them. So the people come down. So I said goodbye to my mother and my brothers and sisters, and they're all crying, but I wasn't crying. I was going off to get my piano. And so we drove for hours, and on the way they asked, do you want chocolate? Do you want? And I said, I'd love a Swiss roll cake. And so they bought a Swiss roll cake, and I ate the whole thing. And then I said, I'd like some chocolate, and they stopped and got chocolate. So finally we get back up north. And we go out to this house, a two-story house, totally barren, out in the middle of a field. And I see upstairs, I'm going to have my own bedroom, which was also going to be great then. I got an indisposition. And they had no indoor bathroom, so they had to run up and down with chamber pots all night. And by the next day, they were sick of me. And then a day later, I said, I have to go home. I miss my mommy, and I want to go home. And they were glad to get rid of me. They put me in the car and drove all the way back.
No and Swiss rolls on the way back on that trip.
Nothing. Not even a drink of tea. Nothing.
There's the old adage that growing up is hard to do. But in growing up, there are always lessons to be learned and qualities we learn about ourselves. The next two stories talk about growing up and lessons we can all keep in mind this holiday season. When Brad Robinson brought his son Forrest into the mobile booth, he came in with the intention to hold on to this recording until Forrest's 16th birthday. Through this conversation, he asks Forrest to describe himself and imagine what lessons he might learn in the future.
How would you describe yourself?
It's hard.
What are you into? Like, what do you like? What do you dislike?
I do not like collards. I dislike pretty much everything at amusement parks.
Right, what do you like?
Oh, what are things I like? I like sitting on the couch. I like getting the same thing twice, like on Christmas or my birthday for some reason.
You like getting the same gift twice?
Yeah.
Why is that?
I don't know.
You're a reader?
Yeah.
So that is that something that you would use to describe yourself, that you're a reader?
Yeah.
Anything else you want to say to describe yourself?
I am a very simple person.
Okay.
Do you remember what was going through your head when you first saw me?
I do. When I first saw you, you were being lifted out of the cut open abdomen of your mother. I was behind this blue sheet and the doctor, and I was sitting there with your mom, and we were just, she couldn't feel anything. And she was naturally kind of freaked out a little bit at the whole situation. So I was trying to keep her calm, and I was also trying to keep myself calm. And then suddenly the doctor said, "Hey Dad, stand up." And I stood up. And then I looked down, and the doctor was just lifting your little body. And he said, "It's Kidzilla," because you were so big. And I almost fell over, but I didn't. So in another 8 years, so 8 years from now, you'll be 16 years old.
Uh-huh.
What do you imagine you'll be like then?
I mean, I think I'll be the same general person.
Well, when you're 16, we're going to make sure you listen to this. What message do you want to give your 16-year-old self?
Try and keep myself from getting hunched by carrying like 10 books in my book bag.
So what advice do you have for your 16-year-old self then when it comes to reading?
Try and keep yourself reading at least. Don't read more than 2 chapter books at a time.
That's good advice.
Do you have any dreams for me? Like things you want me to become or do?
My only dream for you is that you are happy and that you are comfortable in the skin you're in, and that you just live a life where you have lots of opportunities and can pursue them to pursue your dreams.
Our next story comes from best friends Jocelyn Deal and Catherine Kiker. Growing up in military families, neither of them expected they would develop a lasting friendship with anyone. But over the more than 40 years of their relationship, these two have remained close and learned some valuable lessons along the way.
We have been friends for over 40 years. And maybe that's not that unusual in the scheme of life in general, but I think it's kind of unusual in our circumstance because we grew up the daughters of Air Force officers. And so we were military brats and never stayed in one place very long. So do you remember that first day that you walked into our classroom?
Really vaguely. I mean, I remember I had this Dr. Scholl's clogs on. It wasn't even cold in Georgia in October, but compared to Taiwan, it was.
Yeah, definitely.
So I just had my, you know, these sandals and my little hippie clothes. So.
Yeah, your hippie clothes were outstanding. I was very impressed. So first let me say, isn't that just like the worst when you're the new kid and the principal or the assistant principal brings you in and you have to meet the teacher and you stand in front of the class and everybody stares at you?
We moved 13 times before I was 11, so I was really used to it.
Dang.
Yeah.
You were a champ. I have nothing to complain about.
A veteran.
Yeah, definitely.
Well, standing in the front of the room.
I remember you standing up there. You had like the perfect Levi's. You were so adept at finding just the exactly the right style that was in and getting them faded to that perfect blue right before they start blowing out. And, you know, but you would wear them up to that point. And I don't remember what kind of shirt you had on. I remember the shoes were really cool, like not anything I'd ever seen before. And I remember that you jingled when you walked. And for the longest time, I thought I was remembering that you had bells on your shoes. But I think it was on that denim purse. Is that?
God, I have, you
don't,
no,
you have no memory?
I just remember
you
the
jingled.
Doctor. Wow. I could have come in more low-key, I think.
No, I think you wanted to make a statement.
I don't know if my seventh grade self was that together.
I don't think it was any time at all that we became best friends through that situation. So, in fact, I remember one of our teachers said, "Now, you girls are probably going to want to go to the same college." And we were like, "Yeah." And this is eighth grade, right? And she said, "But you need to have different roommates." And we kind of looked at her and she said, "Because you don't really need anyone else. You're not going to expand your world if you don't, if you don't have anyone else." I think it stands out for me because I wasn't thinking that we were excluding people. For a short time, we actually lived across the street from each other, but that was after I had divorced. And you know, you never told me when I was with my first husband what you thought of him, and you definitely helped me stay gone when I decided to leave him, and I really do appreciate you giving me that advice.
Well, I totally understood what you saw in him.
Okay.
I mean, he was brilliant, but I trusted you. I mean, I trusted you to know what you needed at the time.
There was just such an intense connection, you know? And and sometimes I've wondered if we kind of set the stage for that, like, through our friendship. You know, I mean, I also think we set the stage for great things, like our successful marriages and our parenting successes. But I wanted to say one other thing that I remember. You used to always say that I was ahead of you, and I think you meant in, like, life milestones, but I always felt that you were ahead of me from that very first moment when you walked in and you did jingle. You did have bells on you somewhere, and you had such a style and a poise. You had like a fearlessness about a determination to be yourself. And through my life, that has stayed with me about how influential that's been on the kind of person that I became. And I'm so thankful that you did come into my seventh grade class.
Jingler.
In addition to reminiscing about the past and looking forward to the future, the holidays are all about making memories that will last a lifetime. These last three conversations hold true to the idea that good memories can stick with you forever. The next story comes from the funny duo that is Judge Lawton Stevens and retired Dean Paul Kurtz. Kurtz was Stevens' professor in law school at UGA, and they've since become great friends. In this conversation, they trade memories from growing up and one special memory from Professor Kurtz's law class.
Question to you, Paul, is how did you happen to come south? You're originally from New York.
That's right.
And my first question is, how did you get here? And then more importantly, when are you going back?
Well, I got here because I went to college and eventually law school in Nashville. My mother had told me that if I went to school in Nashville as opposed to the New York, that I'd learn about a different part of the country and I'd learn about people different from the people I grew up with. And the unspoken assumption, I'm sure, on my mother's part was that eventually I would come home. But I fell in love with Vanderbilt, and then I fell in love with a young woman who has now been my wife for 47 years. And it was a wonderful time. And I learned about other people in other places, but I mostly learned about myself. Yeah. Eventually, I interviewed for a job here at the University of Georgia, and as I tell people, it's now 2018, which means that since I arrived in 1975, so this is our 43rd year of my three-year plan, and I think it worked. So you went to high school. You did go to high school, right?
I mean, I did, yes. In fact, I graduated.
Well, your word is as good as most any. But you didn't go to high school here in Athens. You grew up in Athens.
That's very true.
But you didn't go to high school here. So tell me about where you went to high school and how it was.
When I got to be in the ninth grade, they decided they would send me to a boarding school. It was an all-male boarding school.
So you got sent away to boarding school.
Yes, I did. Thank you. And back at that time, we had the rat system. Mm-hmm. So if you're a freshman, I mean, you're not a human. You're called a rat. And you had to do whatever the upperclassmen said to do. Basically, just your average abuse. But one of the upperclassmen were having a rap meeting, and they were shining a flashlight in my face, asking me to recite point number 29 of the rat code. And then I didn't quite get it right, so one of them grabbed me by the collar. And, of course, you had to wear a coat and tie. And my clip-on tie came off in his hand. And he threw it on the ground, and he called everybody else, all the other captains of all the other sports team, and they all kind of gathered around me. And said, "What's the matter, rat? Your mommy didn't teach you to tie a tie. You'll never wear another clip-on as long as you live." And I haven't because of that. I was so traumatized.
What's your favorite memory of law school?
Well, I really always liked the one where I was sitting next to my roommate. My roommate was a best friend in law school. It was the late Robert Sundberg. And we were taking criminal law from you. And we had this huge book that had cases all over the country, you know, these cases. And we came up with this Sundberg versus the state and in the front of the whole class. And you said, "All right, Sundberg versus the state. Any relation, Mr. Sundberg?" And Robert goes, "That's my brother, man." Oh, gosh.
That was one of the few times you've seen me at a loss for words,
humma,
right?
Humma.
So if this was going to be our very last conversation, and maybe it will be, actually.
Possibly
we can probably
could
arrange
be.
It. If this is going to be our last conversation, what would you want to say to me or tell me?
I'd want to thank you for being a friend. You always were a professor that it was very obvious that cared about their students, and that's important. And we're all indebted to you for starting us off on our careers. Even those who are in prison probably thank you for all that help.
When Mike Conroy met his future wife, Liz, he had another woman in his life, a beloved dog named Maybelle. In this conversation, Mike and Liz talk about Maybelle's role in bringing them together and the profound impact she's had on their lives.
And I'd like to talk with him today about how his lovely Labrador Retriever helped us become husband and wife as we are today.
Uh-huh.
So, Mike, can you start us off on what Your lovely dog?
My lovely dog. Some 33 years ago, before I met Liz, I was invited to pick out a puppy from my Labrador Retriever litter from friends of mine who lived in South Carolina at the time. And I picked out one with very long ears. And it turns out that independently, my friends had picked out that dog for me themselves, but they didn't tell me. So we picked out the same dog. They said, that's Mike's dog. I named the dog Maybelle for Maybelle Carter.
We met, I was dating someone else and he was dating someone else, and we met at this little place called the Friendly Inn. But the funny, what I remember the most was when I was introduced to Mike, he looked at me and rolled his eyes, and I thought, what a rude man this guy is, because he's not even giving me eye contact. Well, I learned later he had broken up with his girlfriend and was planning to move to Georgia, and so he really didn't want to meet anyone new at that point.
Well, how did Maybelle behave to you when you first met her?
So when I first started visiting Mike, because actually we bumped into each other again at several different music festivals, and Mike said he played old-time guitar. Well, I was learning guitar at that time. I said, okay, well, I will go ahead and learn some chords and music from this rather rude man, but at least I'll have some good lessons. So I went to his little cabin out in the wood, and his black lab, Maybelle, was very polite. She wagged a little bit and sniffed me, but she kept her distance. Well, she was Mike's girlfriend, and that was clear when Mike and I decided to go somewhere in his car, and she jumped in the front seat, and I said, Maybelle, get out. And she looked at me, and she just went dead weight. She slunk into that seat so much. And I'm pretty strong. I was physically fit. I could not move her. She made it clear I was the interloper.
We were dating by this time, and we like to go visit some of the military parks around, and other parks around the Washington and Baltimore areas. And at Gettysburg, we were starting to get some connection with each other, but it wasn't yet real romantic. Well, Maybelle, I think, Liz, you were walking Maybelle, weren't you?
On the leash, yeah.
And Liz didn't realize that Maybelle was trained to heel on the left side. I was walking on Liz's left, and she was trying to heel Maybelle on the right. Well, Maybelle kept trying to circle around and get on the correct side, which would be the left side. And in the process, she wrapped the leash around me and Liz and kind of knocked us together. And if you've seen the old Disney movie, 101 Dalmatians, there's a scene in there where the owners get brought together by their dogs, and there's a leash wrapping scene. So that was a scene out of that movie. And we got married and moved to Georgia. Within, 6 months? Something like that, yeah. I mean, Maybelle was with us for quite a number of years, and she lived to, I believe it was 16 years old. Can you tell us how you were with her when she died?
The ending was harsh, but it was funny because even though it was harsh, I just felt a lot of love for her. And I held her in my arms, and I realized we had come a full circle. She had never wanted me in her life, because I was stealing away her beloved Mike. And yet at the end, we were both best of friends, and I'll always love that dog.
Our final conversation comes from mother and son, Tyrita and Antonio Starks. In this conversation, they discuss their favorite memories together, Antonio's hopes for the future, and Antonio shares an interesting talent. Here's Tyrita and Antonio.
Who do you think is the most important person in your life, and can you tell me about him or her?
I think that would be you.
Oh, really?
Mm-hmm. I say you because you're the one who I'm around mostly.
Oh, so it would easily be someone else if you're around them more?
Not really.
So, tell me why. Why is that so?
Because you're my mama and you had a very positive influence on my personality.
I think there's going to be like a project at school for you that you can kind of get a glimpse of. What do you want to be when you grow up? You want to talk about that?
I want to be comic book illustrator or storyboard artist, or maybe some guy who works on official designs of characters and things.
That sounds pretty fun. And you said you want to live in Japan?
Japan or New York.
Okay. Are you going to take me with you?
Probably. When I get settled.
Oh, so you're going to leave me here? Is that?
Well, I don't know.
When you have the intentions of meeting God, what do you want to say to him?
I just ask him questions about life.
Like what? Like what are you going to ask him?
How'd he figure out to make the perfect koala?
You're serious too, aren't you?
When are you going to teach me how to pay taxes and bills?
They're going to come soon enough. Don't worry. But I'll teach you more about them.
How do they even work?
It's automatic. You don't have to do anything but breathe.
How would you describe me?
I would say you are sensitive, but yet strong. I think you're a handsome dude. You're tall. You're meaty. But that can be a plus. I'm meaty, too. You're very intelligent. You love people. You're kind. You're generous. You're thoughtful. Those are good attributes. That's who you are. Would you agree?
I guess.
That's probably a yes or a no.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. You know what? It's been a long time. Why don't you sing a song for me?
No.
Why not?
Because I could whistle.
Okay. What are you going to whistle?
Think of a Christmas song.
You can do Silent Night.
Okay.
Okay.
Thank you for joining us for StoryCorps Athens, and we hope you and your family have a wonderful holiday season. StoryCorps Athens stories were recorded in fall of 2018 in the StoryCorps mobile booth at the Athens Clark County Library. These interviews were recorded as part of a national initiative to record and collect the stories of everyday people. Excerpts were selected and produced by Morgan Heydrich. For WUGA, I'm Kathy Bradbury.